Our guest today is Terry Scholz. Since 2007, she has reported from Brussels on the European Union, NATO, and the surrounding region. She files international reports on the regular for National Public Radio, CBS Radio, and German broadcaster Deutsche Welle. Scholz covers security, defense, and terrorism. In her career, she has reported from the Baltic states after the fall of the Berlin Wall during the downfall of the Soviet Union. And for more than 6 years, she has also covered the U.S. State Department with former Secretary of State Colin Powell and has made a number of reporting trips to Afghanistan as well. She is from New Mexico and is a graduate of New Mexico State University and even worked here at KRWG Public Media while attending NMSU. Please welcome Terry Scholz. Welcome back to NMSU.
Thank you, Anthony. I thought you weren't going to get to the most important point, that I'm a graduate.
Exactly. Well, that is a very important point, and we're very lucky to have you back here. I'd like to kind of kick things off talking about NATO. Now, you've covered it since 2007. Mm-hmm. How do you feel that NATO is covered today compared to when you first began, and what are the issues that maybe impact that?
Well, I actually got to visit NATO a couple of times while I covered Colin Powell because, of course, the Iraq war was starting. The war in Afghanistan starting just after 9/11 was started while I was covering the State Department. So I got to visit there sort of coming from the outside as Powell tried to ask the allies to support the United States in its wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think living there is much different because now I try to look for stories on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And the stories are not that dramatic as a war just beginning. But, you know, the war in Afghanistan has been going since 9/11. And so a lot of what I report about now is how the other countries, which are now 29 allies, how they relate to the United States, how they have continued to support the United States in Afghanistan. I would say that we cover it. I'm the only American broadcaster covering NATO on a regular basis. The others just come in for summits and leave again. But I think the difference is that I'm there. That really makes a big difference because I report stories that otherwise wouldn't get out because they're not connected to a summit. At the same time, there are a lot of transatlantic tensions right now, and a lot of what we end up reporting about NATO is actually about the U.S. relationship to NATO.
Well, let's talk about that. President Trump obviously has railed on NATO members, saying that they're not paying their fair share,
right,
comparing allies to freeloaders. There was that awkward breakfast.
That's true.
So how do these comments impact relations between the U.S. and NATO from what you've found in your reporting?
It's a really complicated situation because the U.S. pays the most for NATO. I mean, it's the biggest economy, certainly has the biggest military of any of the allies. Some of the allies don't actually even have a standing military. So the U.S. by far outsizes any other country, and it has diplomatic weight to go along with that. So when the U.S. is unhappy with the other NATO allies, they can't ignore it. I mean, besides the fact that any decision taken in NATO has to be taken by consensus, that means that even a tiny country could hold up a U.S. decision, but it also means that the U.S. can stop any other progress from going forward unless the alliance as a whole makes them happy. I think that under President Trump, it's a situation nobody has ever experienced before. Since NATO was established following the end of World War II, this situation has never happened where the United States literally was threatening to pull troops out of Europe, to withdraw funding support, criticizing in such crass terms the relationship with other countries. Nobody has ever experienced this before. It's interesting. I have to say that I tend to look at stories not as good or bad, but simply interesting, and it is certainly interesting.
Now, this is obviously a different time, something we've never seen before. I'd like to get your thoughts on, as being a reporter and just understanding the media in general, do you think Americans really understand the mission of NATO compared to previous generations?
That's a good point. And I have to say that I was present when one of the outgoing Defense Secretary Robert Gates told NATO, "I'm the last defense secretary you're going to have who really knows what you're about, and so you guys better get it together." I would say that current Defense Secretary Mattis, having been an active military guy, he also gets NATO. Maybe Robert Gates was a little bit too pessimistic, but it is true that those generations of leaders are retiring never to return because they lived through, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of the Cold War, these kind of things that made NATO what it is today, are really the most important and, they would say, successful military organization. But no, generations today, generations of Americans, I mean, this may come up in later in our interview, I feel like the American mind is just getting narrower and narrower. So I think that the days to come are going to be worse than today in terms of people not understanding what NATO is about, not understanding what it's done. And what NATO would point out is that the only time that the underlying principle of NATO, which is all for one, one for all, Article 5, has ever been declared, was in defense of the United States
after
9/11, correct. And Americans don't know that. They think that, in my impression, they think they're just giving and giving and giving to NATO. They don't recognize that NATO also has given back to the United States. And I think that's something I try to highlight in my reporting, just as a matter of education.
Partnerships and military alliances also may bring arms deals with different countries. Do you think that this type of kind of colder relations between the United States and NATO could also impact defense companies? Are they concerned? Have you had any conversations with policy analysts?
Well, there are other factors that are governing arms deals. I mean, there's one thing about NATO, and that is that they all have to be able to work together. So there's a lot of cross-purchasing anyway, because what Montenegro uses in its military has to work with what the U.S. uses, which has to work with the German arms, which has to work with the Greek arms. So everybody inside NATO has to have equipment that works together, right? You can't go to war together if you can't use these bullets and those guns, or you can't use these planes and that fuel. So, I mean, there's already a lot of interaction about who should buy what and what kind of deals they're going to be making. But there are other factors afoot in Europe. The Europeans are trying to now create what they call permanent structured cooperation, where they make joint purchases, which hasn't been done before, and they lose a ton of money, and it's really inefficient that each country makes its own purchases. So they're starting now to try to make joint purchases between European countries, and the U.S. doesn't like that so much. It fears that it is going to lose arms sales because the Europeans are going to start probably buying more European instead of the U.S. leading the way in arms sales. So this is something that we should very much be watching, about what kind of impact developments in European cooperation have on U.S. defense sales.
Is that really a response from the harsh trade talk between the United States and the EU?
Not so much the trade talk, but the military talk that we've been discussing about how, with the U.S. threatening under President Trump that it will withdraw its support, that it won't be providing anything Europe needs anymore. The Europeans have said this forever, but now they really believe it could be true, that they have to get themselves together. They have to be able to defend themselves. And so they're saying, well, in order to do that, we need to band together our smaller countries and be able to have a stronger military capability based in Europe for Europe if the U.S. really does pull back and is not our biggest defender anymore. So it's more, I think, something they've always known they should do for efficiency's sake. And now they're doing it out of some fear that President Trump truly will not be there to back up the Europeans if they need it.
Speaking of President Trump, not long after his NATO trip, he had that summit with Putin.
That's right, I was there.
In Helsinki, you were there.
I was there.
So, I mean, that moment, and I'd like to gain your perspective, or your, you know, what you saw when the president, even though he was warned and informed by U.S. intelligence agencies that they concluded that Russian operatives who report to Putin interfered in the 2016 election. What he said, you know, quote, "I don't see any reason why it would be Russia." The response from that, being there in that room, I mean, what was that like? And also NATO's response too. I'd like to hear that.
Well, technically, I was live the whole time the meeting was happening, so I wasn't in the room. But I was there trying to figure out what they were saying, because, of course, the most alarming part for outsiders about that meeting was the extraordinary length of time that the two men were alone. And we will never know what was said. Well, hopefully somebody did actually tape it somewhere, and, you know, tapes will leak. People like me want to know what was said, really. What we most talked about then was how we wouldn't actually know what was said, because there were only interpreters. and the interpreters aren't going to talk. But being there was like, just think about the fact that you and I were smiling when we talked. We're like, holy cow, that summit in Helsinki. You and I are proof that that meeting was odd. That meeting was, to many people, alarming because of this one-on-one relationship where even President Trump's advisors would like him to take a more standoffish position with regard to President Putin, who, if you're in Europe, I mean, the relationship with Russia is very, very difficult and complicated and at times dangerous. And they would very much like to see the U.S. standing up to Moscow a lot more than it seems to be doing by the relationship between the two presidents. That said, U.S. legislation, U.S. actions have not been soft on Russia. They have not withdrawn sanctions. They have not rolled back any of the measures. In fact, they've taken new ones, including against this espionage. So while this Helsinki meeting made many people uncomfortable, both in the U.S. and in Europe, by the warmth between the two leaders, given what we know has happened, the actual results on the ground have not played out to be soft on Russia. And that's something that I look at very carefully because the Europeans are very worried about this. If the U.S. goes soft on Russia, Europe is sitting right there in the middle. The very reason that NATO was created, to keep Europe safe, including from Russia, is at stake. So this is something I have my finger on the pulse of every single day.
Now, I'd like to talk a little bit more about President Trump's foreign policy approach that's been, you know, called America First. Do you feel, from what you've seen, that is that bringing Europe together or is it pulling Europe apart?
That's an interesting question. Probably both. Probably both. They, the Europeans, very much do not like this America First policy because they want, before President Trump came into office, for years of the Obama administrations, there was in negotiation what was called the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP, and they were on the verge of creating what would be the largest single market in the world. They were going to sign a deal where there were no tariffs and, you know, workers could go back and forth, goods could go back and forth. And President Trump said, nope, that's going to be dead when I come in. And so Europeans already are not very happy about what has happened in trade under President Trump. Not just that, but he has since put huge tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from Europe. The Europeans have retaliated. It's really a mess. Trade, transatlantic trade right now is really, really in a precarious spot. So they don't like the America First because they want to be able to sell European products. And that the trend was very much warming on transatlantic trade and reducing tariffs and reducing barriers of all kinds. And now under President Trump, walls are being built, so to speak, in trade.
How do you feel the United States' image is in Europe right now, especially in the last couple of years since President Trump's been president?
Since you were last there a couple of years ago, I would say that it has... It's hard to talk about this. I mean, but it has gone down. People don't trust the United States the way they did before. I have lived, since I left New Mexico State in 1988, I've lived in Europe 20 of those years. So 20 of the 30 years I've been out of New Mexico State have been in Europe. So I think I have a pretty good sense of a timeline here. And I have never seen relations so poor. I've never seen the Europeans feel so misunderstood. I mean, they really feel like the White House hates them. And I have to say that I just interviewed the new U.S. ambassador to the EU, and he says he doesn't hear that. So to be fair, I hear from other sources that in private meetings, the Europeans are not saying they believe the U.S. hates them. But publicly, that is what they think. They think that they're being, that President Trump is unfair to them, that he doesn't recognize the strong allies that the Europeans are in trade as well as in defense. So they don't feel that President Trump appreciates the history, because he himself admits he doesn't study history. You know, he's not interested in the backstory. And for the Europeans who live every day steeped in history, as you well know from having been there, they don't want to hear that history doesn't matter. They don't want to see a president who doesn't appreciate the very strong alliances that have been built since the Second World War. So it hurts them very much. And I have to say that, I mean, I think they're just counting it down and hoping that the next election will bring a change. I have to say that honestly.
I'd like to move on and talk a little bit about the European Union. Over the last several years, the EU has seen a rise in similar countries turning inward, a rise in nationalism.
True.
How big of a concern is that right now to the EU?
Huge, huge. Europe is used to pride itself on being open and being very humanitarian-minded and taking in refugees and immigrants coming from difficult places. And since the outpouring of refugees from Syria, in particular, in 2015, the continent was just really overwhelmed by people fleeing a situation which, by international law, they deserve to be given a safe place. That's what the Geneva Convention says, you protect refugees. But they had millions of people coming through Turkey, coming across the Mediterranean Sea. And there were really too many people for Greece and Italy, which are the frontline countries, to deal with. And those people are still living in abhorrent conditions where they landed. Because the rule is that where you land, you have to stay. So while Germany took in 1 million people in 2015 alone, because they understood that, the smaller countries and to the south couldn't deal with it, there are still people living in conditions which none of us should be accepting. We should not be allowing, in my personal opinion, people who are fleeing, I mean, certain death, to be living in mud, in, you know, small islands. And you can't blame it all on Greece. You can't blame it all on Italy. The numbers are just, numbers are too much. And the rest of the European Union has not stepped up with solidarity and said, sure, transfer them up to us in the Netherlands. Sure, give us a few in, you know, in the countries that are northern, in Belgium. Belgium has not done its job in taking in as many as it has. So the European Union has faced the biggest crisis since I've been covering that. And that is all the way since the early 90s, with the fact that they cannot force countries to help bear the burden of these people coming in.
Because they all have their different views on it.
They
all have their different governments and different views on refugees.
And many of them don't want. That's right. And Hungary, for example, doesn't want to take any. And they've tried to say, we're going to punish you by this way or that way. Hungary says, we don't care, and they don't take them. It's a huge problem right now. And it's also crushing, you know. It's also really disappointing when you see the situation that these refugees who deserve asylum are living in. The second factor in that is that a lot of economic migrants have taken advantage of the situation to try to come, and they don't have the right to stay. And so the European countries are dealing with trying to filter out who doesn't deserve a right to stay and then send them back. And it's just an overwhelming situation, and it isn't getting better. And it has created a huge crisis of solidarity within the EU.
To the experts that you talked to, Germany did this amazing thing of taking in 1 million refugees.
In 1 year. Mm-hmm.
Did that help or hurt other countries in being more accepting to refugees? Were they saying, oh, Germany's got that, we're good?
Germany had 1 million. There are still millions more who need a place. A lot of, I think, leaders who may have been thinking about what they wanted to do, we're going to look at the fate of Angela Merkel, the strongest leader in Europe, to see what happened to her, to see if this hurt her, if she was able to maintain her government after she did this, which wasn't popular throughout Germany. And there has been a rise of a right-wing party and probably others to come because they're of the backlash against taking in all these people. Other countries have not stepped up and opened their arms the way Germany has. And again, the EU doesn't really have mechanisms to force them to do so. So I think that some countries have been very honorable. Sweden, for example, has taken in a disproportionate number of asylum seekers. But Finland hasn't. And Norway's not in the EU, but it's one of the richest countries in Europe and could do more than it does. Other countries that are well off, Belgium's well off, the Netherlands is well off, they're not opening their arms. They don't have to. While they take in some, and I can't pretend they don't take in any, they aren't taking in a number that would ease the crisis in the southern states.
You cover defense, security, terrorism. When there's dangerous things happening, you're running towards the danger.
I like that. That's true.
I'd like to hear your thoughts, though, on living in Brussels, a city that experienced a terrorist attack in March 2016 at the airport, mm-hmm. at the metro station.
That's right.
What was that day like for you?
To be honest, this was interesting. The What preceded that were the terrorist attacks in Paris in November of 2015. And at that time, Brussels went on lockdown, even before they knew for sure that this cell, which attacked Paris in even a bigger way than Brussels, was located right there in Brussels, in places that I went frequently with my children, a neighborhood. So we went on lockdown in Brussels. They put the military in the streets from November preceding the terrorist attacks in Brussels. So we felt they shut down our public transportation for 4 days. Schools didn't even meet. After the attacks in Paris, when it started trickling out that these people had planned this attack right there in Brussels, we knew that the threat was higher in Belgium. We just didn't know what that would mean. And so in fact, on the day, March 22nd, I'll never forget it, I was in Lebanon training people. I was giving a training as a media training in Beirut, a place which you normally would think of as more dangerous. And NPR called me and said, there's been some explosion at the airport. And I have to tell you, what I said is, you know, they're always finding unexploded ordnance. They're finishing NATO headquarters, they're digging there. I bet it was just an old World War II bomb that went off. And they're like, okay, we won't worry about it now. And then they called me just a couple minutes later in Beirut and said, no, this is something serious. And then I was stuck in Beirut. And I have two small children living in Brussels. We live 10 minutes from the airport, and we knew this was taking place at the airport, so I was terrified. I couldn't even get home. I had to fly to Amsterdam and find a car and drive back overnight. Didn't sleep forever, went straight downtown, like you said, running towards the scene of the attacks. It changed. I hadn't been that close to a terror attack since 9/11. I mean, I was right in the middle of 9/11. I was covering the State Department, and that was a day unlike any other as well. But since then, I hadn't had those feelings of personal safety, fear for my personal safety, awakened until then. And that was really scary. Our city no longer felt safe. And European cities, for the most part, are safe. We don't have random gun violence, you know? So this, when something like this happens, it's really scary. And it did happen on public transportation where people travel every day very near the Deutsche Welle office where you have been. It was awful. It continues to be awful. There are still they're still unraveling this terror cell that lived right there in Brussels. We're still having trials of some of the surviving bombers in Paris. Brussels will never feel the same as since that attack. Paris certainly doesn't feel the same either. And these little tiny attacks that have happened around Europe since then, of the Al-Qaeda cells, of the ISIS cells that have infiltrated Europe, will continue to be a huge story for our lifetimes. ISIS has warned Europe, we've got sleeper cells everywhere, and to some extent, they've been proving it.
We only have a few minutes left, but I want to talk with you a little bit about international reporting and get your thoughts on some of it. How has it changed since you've first started and went abroad, and compared to today? Are the resources the same?
Oh my gosh, there's no comparison. I was 22 and less than a year out of New Mexico State when I moved to Helsinki, Finland. And if we had a bigger show, I'd tell that story because I think people would be interested. There was no internet. The biggest change in my life as a reporter has been the internet. I can't even remember how I found addresses to apply for jobs in Helsinki, Finland. You know, went to the library. Who would have the broadcasting center's address? So the internet came as I lived in Finland and I worked on a master's there. And suddenly the world became much more accessible. It also became, I think, more dangerous. I personally, because I work for major news organizations where we have editors and we have fact checkers, and I would rather die than get something wrong, you know, broadcasting to the world on NPR, although it does happen. Anybody can report anything. And as somebody who's been broadcasting for the last, more than 30 years, it is offensive to me that people can't figure out the difference between somebody making something up and my story that's been fact-checked, you know, by people who know what they're talking about. What bothers me the most is that fake news is doing so well. And working for genuine, respectable news organizations suffer credibility as a result. So while it's made news gathering much easier, I can report from my laptop. I could file for NPR right here, and I do, out of my laptop with a microphone. That's wonderful. I can be anywhere and file a report, and I love that. At the same time, the ability of other people who don't have society's best interests at heart, their ability to do the same thing, is the downside of that. So those are the biggest changes.
Being abroad, and I'd like to get your thoughts on, do you feel that the United States, people living in the U.S., are as engaged in international news today as maybe they were, you know, perhaps 20, 30 years ago?
Well, again, you can't talk about this without talking about the internet. They have the ability to read anything from anywhere. I mean, I can read I can read Facebook posts from refugees on Greece, and I can read the Greek newspaper too. You know what I mean? There's nothing. I wouldn't give that up for anything. That I can see what's happening because of the internet. So I think it's possible to be more engaged. There's no excuse for not knowing what's going on in the world. There's absolutely no excuse. I'm continually heartbroken that people don't care. So we have the ability to do it more, but our generations, our parents and their parents, lived through the ending of a world war. They saw the horrors that Nazi Germany created for the world, and they saw the world try to come together after that. So I think they grew up understanding what peace is and how important peace is. And I think that made them more interested in what was happening around the rest of the world, even if it was less accessible because you had to find a newspaper reporting on international news, or, you know, the means by which you got that news was more difficult. But I think they had an innate sense of caring and understanding what was at stake in not understanding. And if I can do anything in my career, it's to increase the understanding of young people, well, and old alike, to wanting to understand what's happening in the rest of the world. I devote my life to it.
Well, we want to thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
It's such a pleasure. I'm so proud to be an Aggie. This school gave me everything I needed, and KRWG as well, so I wouldn't want to leave without saying that. I'm really proud to have been here.